Well, let's get started. I want to welcome all of you to this call. It's a series of teleconferences I'm doing. I'm doing this to expose doctors to some possibilities. I've done some teleconferences with several of my clients over the last couple of months. I have some of the people that work with me on the call tonight as well. We have used a mailing list from people that bought our book, Playing Your A Game. I've interviewed three people that are actually in the book. I've interviewed Dr. Rye Spohr in Seattle, Dr. April Zigley in Sumner, Washington. Dr. Dunson tonight is from Atlanta. Bernie is actually not in our book, but he's one of our participants in our coaching program that has done very well and has created what I would consider a very unique practice, in that he does primarily implants, IV sedation. And he's actually moved his practice from a general dental practice and to this downtown Atlanta practice where he does nothing but implants and the restorative part on implants. Now, one of the things I'd like everybody listening in to understand is that I don't believe there's only one model or half a dozen models. There are a million models to make a practice work. And as you listen to Bernie and I have this conversation, I want you to be sure and ask questions to ask Bernie or myself when we give you that opportunity, and we'll do that several times during the call. I do want you to understand that I'm not promoting any one particular style. I mean, Bernie has a unique practice, and so don't come away from the call and say, well, I don't want to do what Bernie's doing. That's okay. It's the same thing. People have talked to various people in our book, and if you've read the book, and if you haven't read it, I'd encourage you to do so. We're giving the money from that book to the Oregon Dental School, which is building a new school, and that has allowed me to become the dean's new best friend. So I appreciate all that support, and we're giving the rest of the money to the Juvenile Betis Research Foundation. We were giving it to the American Diabetic Association, and then we found out that all of their research is on type 2. And since our daughter has type 1, and also Nancy Granahan, who works with us, has type 1, we wanted the money to go to that. So that's where it's going. Bernie's practice is in downtown Atlanta. He moved from a suburb outside of Atlanta where he had a very general practice to this new practice. But what I'd like you to do tonight, Bernie, is give us a little thumbnail sketch of your journey through dentistry since the time that you got interested in implants and what you did training-wise and kind of the same, just a short version of what you did at that Purple Cow seminar in Chicago. For those of you that were not at that Purple Cow seminar, there is a DVD available of that. It will be available, I guess, within the next week. But we introduced several different concepts. One was sleep apnea. One was elevated CRP. We had three doctors speak on implants, implant-supported dentures, IV sedation, etc. And, of course, the reason is that if you've read Seth Godin's book, The Purple Cow, Turning the Ordinary to the Extraordinary, Haagen-Dazs ice cream, Starbucks coffee, etc., 15 years ago, 10 years ago, and even 5 years ago, cosmetic dentistry was still somewhat of a purple cow. If you were a cosmetic dentist, it made you somewhat unique in a marketplace, although the question that I've asked everyone at this point is, how many cosmetic dentists are there in your community? And generally the answer is all of them. And so we looked at some other areas, and I think these are very interesting, and since Bernie has this practice pretty much exclusively to implant and implant-related, I thought this would be interesting. Bernie also happens to be the national membership chairman for the AAID, I just recently spoke at their seminar in Chicago. So, Bernie, why don't you start? First off, give us just a little thumbnail sketch of going into general practice and then how you got interested in implants and how you made the transition.
I'll be happy to. First of all, I'm from Georgia, and I went to college in Atlanta, but I got an opportunity to go to dental school in Los Angeles. So I went to dental school at the University of Southern Cal, and I finished dental school in 1991. From there, I did a general practice residency actually in New York at Columbia University, and I was based at Harlem Hospital. It was there that I was significantly exposed to implant dentistry. I had some interest in dental school, but I really got exposed when I was doing my residency. And my interest was piqued to the degree that I actually enrolled in, after I finished my residency, I did a 3-year implant residency program that was based at Loma Linda University. And the nature of my program, it was a hospital-based program. I was based in Atlanta, and every other month I'd have to travel to California for about 10 to 12 days and do my training, and then I'd come here and do all of my rotations in Atlanta, and I rotated through anesthesia, rotated through ENT, rotated through orthopedics, and also oral surgery. But once I finished my residency, the significant thing about my residency in implants was, as a part of the training, I had to get IV sedation training. And one of the things that turned out to be was a great stream for me in terms of new patients, because I was capable of doing restorative dentistry and doing IV sedation. And I think even in Atlanta today, that's a very unique distinction relative to the number of practicing dentists that do restorative dentistry that are sedation trained is quite rare. There are obviously a lot of surgeons who do oral surgery who have IV sedation training, and I mean specifically oral surgeons. I mean, it is very hard to find an endodontist. I don't even know of one that has IV sedation training in Atlanta, and a periodontist. So it's kind of unique because I can sedate patients and restore them. And my practice now, and Bill and Carolyn have helped me tremendously relative to kind of carving out and creating clarity and getting the kind of practice that I, you know, envision and dream of, is a advanced restorative practice. It's truly a restorative practice with a significant surgical component, and that component being bone grafting and implant dentistry. I just think IV sedation is something that I have in my repertoire, in my armamentarium, that I could not do without in terms of what I do for my patients, just from the simple major restorative procedures that we do.
Let me ask you a question. You and I have had this conversation, but I'd like you to share this with the group on the call tonight.
Sure.
About 2 years ago, we have a client who's actually in our book, and I actually, when I was telling you about doing some interviews with people in the book, Dr. Zach Hodgins down in Florida.
Right.
And this is where this whole thing on this new purple cow got started, was that Zach had been all through LVI. He was doing cosmetics. He was doing relatively well in Orlando. And one day, just in a casual conversation, one of our monthly coaching calls, I said, Zach, how many cosmetic dentists are there in Orlando? And he said, well, about 1,000 of them. And I said, why don't we go a different direction? Let's look at the demographics of Florida, for example. And Florida has fantastic demographics for implants, because you've got, we won't call them old people, but we'll call them mature citizens that are moving down to Florida. A lot of them are in need of dentistry. Of course, people with missing teeth, there was a reason they're missing teeth. It wasn't because endo and Crown and Bridge wasn't available to them. They chose not to, and a lot of them chose not to because they're dental phobics. And about that time, the oral sedation was becoming very popular, and Florida, among other states, was starting to create more restrictions. I get a kick out of the fact that when we all got out of dental school, we could give Seconal to children by the teaspoons,
right,
to do pedo fillings, and nobody cared. But as soon as general dentists started doing oral sedation on adults, several of the specialty groups started saying, well, in the interest of public safety, we're going to make some more certification on that. So they made all kinds of rules. So I said, let's just play their game. So become certified in IV sedation. And for those of you who were on that call, you might remember that Zach took that practice from $800,000 to $2 million in 2 years by adding those two components to his practice. And he went through Carl Misch's program, a weekend a month for a year, and got his IV training. Bernie, how would you say that the IV training has helped you in comparison to people doing oral sedation? Because oral sedation has become fairly popular, and yet I haven't seen that it's really helped too many people marketing-wise. How do you distinguish yourself in that?
Well, I mean, like you said, I mean, I have to have an IV sedation certification to do what I do. How it helps me, it kind of relates to the fact that it's a lot safer.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a lot more control. I can control my time windows a lot better, because with IV sedation, I have direct access whereby I can reverse a patient.
Mm-hmm.
I do oral sedation in rare instances, and I much rather do IV sedation for the safety factor.
Yes. Yeah, you mentioned when you did that program for us that you feel safer doing IV sedation than you do doing general anesthetic.
Oh, absolutely. I said it's actually statistically safer to do IV sedation than it is to give a local anesthetic.
That's what I meant.
Right, a local anesthetic.
I said local. I said general. Meant local, correct.
And that's very true. I got from doing the Purple Cow, and based on some of the questions that I received, that people are, in some respects, or dentists are, in some respects, fearful of doing it. But in essence, once you learn how to do it, you have a tremendous degree of confidence and safety. I mean, we all are faced with some degree of urgency and emergency within our practice, or at least we should be trained to manage one. Well, with the IV sedation training, you're definitely there. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, being on the other side, I will say I'm a lot more comfortable.
Bernie, you mentioned that we helped you with the clarity of making this decision from your going from the general practice, and you already had all this training. You were doing general dentistry, and you were doing this higher-end dentistry. What did Carolyn and I do to help you become clear on that?
You quite honestly gave me an opportunity to explore my dreams and face my fears about, you know, what if. And gave me an opportunity to say, let me just go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2 years, I've transitioned from where I was in practice. I was in Stone Mountain, Georgia, which is about 14 miles east of the city. And Carolyn and Bill sat down with me, and we talked about where I wanted to be. I live in town. And so I moved a practice 14 miles or 15 miles. I'm now 5 minutes from my practice. I'm in a beautiful building in Midtown Atlanta. I overlook the city. You're only going to get to see me. I mean, you don't see my practice when you drive by. You just got to know I'm there. I'm centrally located, which avails me to other dentists to refer to me who are, you know, whose patients have services that I might be able to help out. So a lot of things are opening up to me, and this is very new. I mean, I've been in the new practice for 2 months, and there hasn't been a day that I haven't been trying to figure out my schedule. I'm booked out until January. And, I mean, it's just got, the sky's the limit from this. I just got to get it organized so that I can really reap the rewards from it. But I haven't skipped a beat from my previous practice. My previous practice was doing well, as you know, Bill.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just now that I'm doing the type of procedures that I spend most of my days seeing one patient a day. Or one patient in the morning. I might do some examinations or consultations in the afternoon, some postoperative visits. But it just makes for a nice schedule when you're going to sedate a patient and do surgery or do restorative dentistry. And from a accounting standpoint, it works out a lot better because on most of these cases, I'm in a strong position to get an entire fee up front rather than some of the other things that I was traditionally doing.
Bernie, let's talk a little about the business side of this practice.
Sure.
Let's talk about you found the location, you found the market. How do you market this? How do you market your new practice? I mean, a lot of your old patients, some of your old patients came with you, some didn't. What have you done to market this new practice?
Well, we're actually working with Rocket Dog Dental out of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
We also have.
Thank you, Lisa.
We also have a relationship with Einstein, which is doing my website.
Mm-hmm.
I have found that is a. I mean, I get a lot of internet activity whereby we're scheduling patients for consultations related to the procedures that we do. My wife is my marketing director, and we're in the process of developing some new print ads, which are going to be distributed in some local magazines in efforts to generate and pique some interest for the specific things we do.
Bernie, how much networking do you do with other dentists?
Where I've done that in the past is because I've been asked to speak at local society meetings. I used to be on the Medical College of Georgia's guest lectures series, and so that interaction and being at a member of the American Academy of Implant Dentistry and then being involved in the leadership roles in that academy have availed me to I guess in some respects, younger dentists or dentists interested in getting involved with implant dentistry. And from that, locally, dentists will send me cases, whether it be grafts that they are not interested in doing, or I have some prosthodontists. I've got my best two referrals are prosthodontists, and they don't even seek to restore them. They just want me to do the procedure from beginning to end, and I'm very okay doing that for them.
Mm-hmm. Bernie, when you get clients from the internet,
yeah.
Tell us how your staff screens those people on the phone. I mean, you obviously don't see every patient that gets on your website.
Well, we've got the Black for Power questions that we have a script, and you obviously can provide that for them. They use it every time, and it's essentially a great screening tool to see, one, to get to the hot buttons for the patient and to see how serious they are about what it is we can offer for them. Most of the time when they get beyond that point, when they come to our office, I had one in today as an example, and her response to me, because I did a preliminary examination for her, my steps or my systems in my practice take her to what would be a next step, because she's a type 3 case where she's completely edentulous in the posterior mandible and she's got some degree of bite collapse, is that I'll do diagnostic records. And her response to me was, based on what I've seen and what was the initial interview on the telephone, whatever you say, Dr. Dunson, I'm ready to move forward with it. And I just found that to be a lot. It was so pleasing to get that, because you're not challenged by trying to, educate a patient, this kind of thing. It's not that I don't educate them. It's just that they're ready to go forward. It's kind of like they're preheated. And
for those of you listening in, our seven questions are basically, how can I help you? And we go from there and stay on the right side of the brain to how long has this been a problem and what have you done about it so far? How's it affected you? And what have you done? How's it worked? And what if we could improve your life by doing this? And then we go right ahead and talk about, have you thought about a budget? And so by the time these patients get to Bernie's office, the people on the phone have already started talking about money. For those of you who are on the call with Rise Spore, his office manager, Maria, very often tells people that she asked that question, and that's a great question, is where are you in your research? It sounds like you've been doing some research on this situation, on implants, or whether it be crown and bridge or veneers or whatever they're calling about. Where are you in your research? For example, have you already decided to do the procedure and now you're shopping for a dentist, or are you still thinking about whether you're going to do the procedure or not? And you see, that question starts to differentiate right there. It's a fork in the road. Do we now ask more questions and talk about the procedure, that is selling the procedure, or do we now find out what she's looking for in a dentist? And so that very often becomes the direction of what they're looking for in a dentist. And they're generally looking for somebody with experience. They're looking for somebody who, if it's in the cosmetic area, can show photographs of actual work. And they're generally somewhat interested in the economics as well. I mean, everybody's interested in how much is this going to cost. And by telling people up front, I mean, Rise's assistant, or when Rise did this call with us, he mentioned the fact that Maria actually tells them, we're probably going to be the most expensive in Seattle, and which he probably is. He's at $2,500 a unit, I believe. And Bernie, you're not the least expensive place to go in Atlanta for implants and restorative dentistry.
No, I'm not. I'm not the least expensive by far.
And your staff then goes ahead and talks about what these cases may cost on the phone.
Sure, sure.
And then for those of you not doing this, this is something we teach in our coaching program, and we teach it to your staff. And it's just a phenomenal tool, because so often you spend so much time with a patient, and the old style was to, come in, bring them in, doing a complete examination, spend an hour doing an exam, another hour by yourself doing a treatment plan, working up estimates, and then bringing the patient back for a consultation. And sometimes what is very often the final 30 seconds, if you ever see that patient, you tell them how much it's going to be, of which you see the back of the patient heading out of your office, never to be seen again. And you've just wasted 2 hours of your time. And so, Bernie, tell us a little bit about how quoting the fee on the phone, how do you do that, and how does she come up with a range? Or not? We don't want to give a range. That's the wrong
sure.
word.
We discuss things when using some of the dialogue that you've talked about. This will be somewhere around the investment of a nice luxury car. Tiffany is my administrative coordinator. She's been with me 10 years. and so she's extremely well-versed. It's, I have one other administrative person who might feel that call, but when Tiffany's on the call, I've got a lot of confidence because she can ask the right questions about the person's condition and kind of get them in a range as to where and what the costs are going to be. And from that perspective, I mean, we're talking in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $50,000 for a case. And if a patient's still interested in coming in and seeing, you've got to be cautious when you talk about a range because they might need bone grafts, onlay grafts, these kinds of things, and that could actually, you know, accelerate or elevate the cost a little bit. But what's nice about that is if they have received the $50,000 mark and they're still interested in coming in, at least we've crossed that hurdle. And like I said, they're preheated, and I don't spend as much time as I used to going through dialogue about things like that.
You know, Rise has a very unique practice as well, and he was telling us on the call that, you know, he's doing large restorative cases, and he says he spends about 5 minutes after Maria does her interview, and he basically tells the patient, yes, he can do this, and he's looking forward to it, and ask them what they want to do. And that's about as far as he goes before the patient makes their decision. He does not do a very complex examination, which is something that we've taught. How do you do that when a case is as complex as implants? I mean, how long do you spend on an exam before the patient is basically asked what they would like to do?
I spend about 30 minutes with a patient, mm-hmm. and I'm looking for, you know, I do a clinical exam. I do a TMJ screening, but I'm looking to see what type of bone I have available, what the thickness of that bone is, and then from there we have a discussion about bringing them in for diagnostic records. And a diagnostic records appointment is about an hour where I take models and I take photographs. But we're talking about a second appointment of which the patient is in a position, for the most part, where they're already interested in doing what we do. So I kind of do like what we call a quick look exam in my consultation visit to see where they are. But I used to spend about an hour and a half, so to spend 30 minutes now is a lot different. It frees me up for actually doing treatment.
I remember when we first started to work with you, you were spending an hour and a half on an exam, and one of your comments was that so often these people didn't materialize into treatment anyway.
That's right. My conversion ratio was a lot less then than it is now, and I'm spending less time because we've got the specific questions that get us right to the point of, if you're interested, let us know. And then it becomes a question of whether the patient's ready. And sometimes patients aren't ready. They come in, they're interested, or they're curious, and they're not ready, but I'll tell you that, you know, they plan to come back, if you will.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me talk to you a little bit about your team. I mean, how many, you mentioned Tiffany at the front.
Right.
How many team members you have, and how have you trained your team to help, I use the word sell, this type of treatment? I mean, obviously they've become very comfortable talking.
Well, I didn't train them. You trained them.
Well, you've done the day-to-day with them.
I do the day-to-day with them. Well, let me put that in perspective, too. When I started with you, I had 7-8 team members. Now I reduced down to 4. Now I have 5. So I've kind of reduced my business overhead by 3 employees, and I increased my productivity about $200,000 in that first year that I worked with you. And I also took about 11 days more off. So that's a significant change in where we were.
And that's when you were still basically General Dennis.
I was still in Stone Mountain at the time. Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's right. In terms of training them, we have weekly one-hour meetings. We also have monthly 4-hour meetings. And we do scripting, we do screening. And since my team represents my ears where I can't hear, my eyes where I can't see at times, and my voice where I can't speak relative to them fielding phone calls and interfacing with patients, I get to get some insight on some of the things that they're confronted with, and so we can kind of create a response to it that's philosophically congruent with the practice and so that everybody's on the same page. But essentially we use the 4x4 format to prepare ourselves for the dialogue that happens with the patients.
Yeah, that 4x4 is referring to is Blatchford Motivational Workshop. It's 4 hours every 4 weeks, and the thing that we do emphasize, training of the team is essential. So many teams that I see in offices that we talk to, not ones we're actively working with, but they go to a seminar or they do something, but they don't take the time to train the team. And you said it very nicely. The team are your ears, your eyes, and your mouth very often, and you've got to make sure that those people answering the phone are representing you well philosophically, congruent with your philosophy of practice. I find so often that doctors do not take the time and the effort to train their staff members, and then they wonder why they don't get the results. And I was speaking to as a matter of fact, with the AID, Bernie, I spoke to about 200 team members there, and it was interesting because one of the questions I asked is how many of them have regular, like monthly training sessions, and it was just a handful out of the 200 team members I was speaking to that actually, they said, well, we have staff meetings from time to time, but it's mainly, why do the pencils from the front office end up in the back, and who's going to clean the x-ray processor and things like that, and they don't take the time to train, and then, of course, they wonder why they don't get the results. So you take every 4 hours. Now, when do you schedule those? Is that during productive time, or what do you do?
Oh, yeah, well, it's during productive time. We do it on a Thursday afternoon. I mean, mm-hmm. We'll block that time off. But I'll tell you, when I am not doing the weekly team meetings and the 4x4s, there's a dramatic change in the climate of the practice.
Yes.
And
you got busy when you were making your move, I know, and that kind of fell off for a little bit.
That's correct, and that's why I can speak to it from experience. When I got busy with my move, when I got busy running that Southern District meeting, we didn't have those meetings, and it directly impacted the climate of the practice. I'm talking about the level of stress as well as the productivity. So I think team training and leadership in our practices are directly proportional to being able to do complex restorative dentistry. And, I mean, to practice dentistry where you're doing, for lack of a better word, drill and fill dentistry, it's easy to operate, you know, a volume practice. But when you start getting into cases, obviously you got to have the clinical training and you can expose yourself to that because there's a lot of courses that can get you in a position to do it. But you got to have leadership, and you got to have leadership on all levels. We can convert patients a lot better when everybody on the team is saying the same things.
Yes.
I just think it's so much more powerful and impactful to the patients. And our conversion ratio goes way up, and obviously, you know, we monitor that through your systems as well.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that so often we find the team really doesn't know what to say. The team doesn't know what to say, and so they talk about the weather, they talk about their pets, they talk about their children, and part of the problem is they really don't have a lot of direction from the top what they should be talking about. And so you see, the way you're doing this is the way we teach, is that by the time you're talking to the patient, you're the third opinion. I mean, they've got two opinions from team members before they even get to meet the doctor. The first impression was on the phone, and I think that is critical. And for those of you using websites, you know, we are finding clients today getting as many as 40 and 50% of their production from their website. And that patient calling in from the website is a far different patient than the patients that we used to get from, say, other patient referrals. I mean, they're not as sold just because they've visited your website as that patient who their neighbor referred them because you're such a great office and a great dentist. And so it takes some real skill on the phone. Bernie, let's do this. Let's open this up to some questions here from some of the people listening in. If you want to ask Bernie a question or myself a question at this point, just hit the 6 button on your phone. That opens up your phone. And you can ask these questions. Any of my staff can also ask him questions. Don't all speak at once. Robert, why don't you ask a question? I think he went away. Robert, I think you hit the 6 button and you're already... Robert, are you there? How about Dr. Schnoor?
I guess I'd go back to the original question about being a purple cow and the IV sedation versus the oral sedation. How do patients perceive that, or if that's marketed to them, how do they perceive that as a benefit and drive them to you versus the more widely accepted oral sedation? How is that differentiation made?
Excellent question. Bernie, you want to take that?
You know, Bill, I'm at a disadvantage because I've always been in IV sedation. I don't, you know, and I didn't historically market my practice as a sedation practice. It was an implant practice, and I did a lot of procedures through IV sedation. I don't know how patients differentiate between the oral sedation.
Well, I'll answer what I've seen from other clients that were started out doing oral. Oral is excellent. I don't want you to think that I'm putting down oral sedation in any way whatsoever.
Right.
The reason that I am encouraging my clients to get into IV sedation is because there are so many dentists today doing oral sedation. The DOCS program has become very successful in raising the public awareness that sedation is available, and one of the things that I have seen is that once something becomes popular, all of a sudden it becomes a standard of care. And I made this prediction with cosmetics 15 years ago that would be a purple cow for the next few years. And then a few years ago, I realized that cosmetic dentistry, for example, was now the new standard of care, that everybody does cosmetics. I mean, all you have to do is visit any city, look in the yellow pages, and there's not an ad in the phone book for a dentist that doesn't say cosmetic dentist. And it's getting to be that you find many, many dentists marketing the oral sedation as well, and so I've always kind of steered my clients into areas that take a little more effort to distinguish themselves from everyone else. And I guess that's the answer, Dr. Schnur, is that it's different. And the other thing is, what's nice about the IV sedation too, if you don't want to become certified and do it yourself, you can always have someone else do it. For example, one of my new clients in Chicago, he was at our Purple Cow seminar, and he picked up on the suggestion immediately. Well, it turns out he practices right next to a hospital. The next week, he found two anesthesiologists who are perfectly willing to come over and moonlight in his office and do IV sedation in his office, bring all the equipment in, and they do everything, and all they have to do is, and they bill the patient separately, they interview the patient, do their whole examination, and they charge the patient separately. All financial arrangements for the sedation are done with the anesthesiologist, and I actually have several people doing that. I have one doctor in Baltimore whose son-in-law is an anesthesiologist, and he does it the same way. And what it does, you advertise, like Zach Hodgins said, you advertise the sedation, but it doesn't just bring in sedation patients. It's just like with advertising sedation and implants. It doesn't just bring in sedation patients for implants. It brings in patients for all kinds of restorative dentistry as well, and it brings in that phobic patient, and there's, I think, patients know more about IV sedation than oral sedation. I mean, they've had various medical procedures done with IV, and they don't know about the oral sedation as much. So I think that's the distinction, is that patients know more about it. And Zach Hodgins was a great example of, you know, he was doing the oral, and then he added the IV, and my gosh, his practice just took off. And
Bill, I can add a little to that relative to the state boards and their requirements. There was a time about 18 months ago where you still could practice you could be a general dentist and do oral sedation without an oral conscious sedation certificate. But that changed. Now you've got to go through some testing, expose yourself to airway management with an oral surgeon, or go into the hospital with an anesthesiologist. And like you're saying now, in terms of forecasting the future, all that can change too. Whereas IV sedation is kind of the gold standard to what we do. It's IV conscious sedation. It is the ultimate certificate, if you will, for the procedure. And I think a lot of that's going to change. I have with some other friends in Florida, oral conscious sedation requirements have gotten a lot more stringent down there, to the point where they can't do certain things with their oral conscious sedation that they could do a couple of years back. Whereas if you do IV sedation, you avail yourself to a lot of different medications. You've got the training. You can use oral sedation if you need it. And you're going to be ahead of the curve, and it's going to meet you rather than you always chasing it.
Well, that's what I saw. That was the whole thing with Zach. Right. You know, he was getting to the point in Florida that he said, you know, to do these different procedures, they were asking for more and more certification. And I said, you know, why don't you just jump ahead of them?
Right.
And he took a course.
Montefiore Hospital, and he took it for about 6 days, 7 days. where he immersed himself every day for 8 hours, and he got great training.
And there's a, I just noticed, for example, for the first time in a long time, that the Oregon Health Science Center, the dental school here in Oregon, is now just finished a training program. It was several days by the school on IV sedation. That's the first time they've done that in a long time. So it is coming. I mean, it is coming along, and I'm saying that that's just one way to stay ahead of the curve. And the interesting thing about anything with a purple cow concept, it's just like Starbucks coffee. Starbucks, you know, Schultz, who created the concept, was the first one. It's become a brand name. It's become a generic. Let's go have a Starbucks. Nobody says, let's go have a Pete's. And there's Pete's Coffee Company. There's Seattle's Best Coffee Company. There's any number of these coffee companies started up in Seattle, and Portland is kind of the hub of this gourmet coffee craze. It's interesting that Seattle and Portland are the centers of two crazes. One is microbrew beers, and the other one is this coffee, gourmet coffee craze. But Starbucks became a generic, like Kleenex or Coca-Cola, whereas the second people to come along are always going to have to market heavily to become established. And I think part of the answer is just being ahead of the curve, be the first one in the community to offer it.
And Bill,
Bernie,
this is,
go ahead.
This is Ron, brilliant. How are you?
Go ahead, Ron.
What I wanted to mention is after taking the doc's training 3.5 years ago, realizing that only one dose would be able to be given, you know, no telling how long that would last, I did get my IV sedation training about 3.5 years ago, and like Bernie, we do mainly IV sedation, and the beautiful thing about it is, for oral sedation, even if you can give multi-doses, you have to give sublingual, you have to wait until the effects, it could be 20 minutes, a half hour. Where with IV sedation, you know, a cc or two of Versed, 2 minutes, you're ready to go again.
Right.
The other thing that's very nice is, as you're doing the long appointments, our sedation appointments last sometimes 4, 6, and 8 hours long, where we do the whole realm of dentistry. During the beginning of the appointment, to keep them from being so, you know, soupy, you can put a little glycopyrrolate, anti-salagogue,
right,
dry them, and work in a dry field, and it's just so much, you have so much more control than an oral sedation.
So there's more control and more versatility.
Correct.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more. Let's go back to a little bit more on the business side of this, Bernie, and talk a little bit why general dentists would want to get involved in the implant market part of dentistry. Why would you want to get involved in actually placing implants?
It's lucrative. No.
We have one client in Chicago that literally limits her practice to implants and implant-supported dentures, and she is billing out at the rate of about $9,000 an hour placing implants, and I don't know of anybody billing at that kind of a rate doing restorative dentistry.
I've always been interested in implant dentistry. I felt like there was going to be a segment of the population that I could serve relative to edentulism, and without fail, that's been really true for me. Implant dentistry, when done properly, is extremely predictable, and it can be challenging, and it can be humbling, but for the most part, you can create an atmosphere where it starts to become quite routine. The nice thing for me is, as an example, if I do a sinus graft, I know that 4 months later, there's a tremendously high probability that I'm going to be placing 6 implants. And then 6 months after that, or 4 months after that, I know I'm going to be doing some prosthetic components and some crown and bridge. So it creates a nice stream of predictability relative to the practice. I was with RISE, as an example, this past weekend in Cleveland, and we took a taxi back to the airport together, and one of the things that Rise talked to me about was, you know, he'd like to have a more constant stream, in that some months are great for him and some months maybe aren't so great.
That's right.
So if I'm doing implant dentistry, as an example, like this week, Friday, I did a sinus graft on a patient, placed several implants in the premaxilla. Well, it's 4 months later. Now I'm going to place 6 implants in the posterior maxilla, and I know that in 4 to 6 months after that, depending on the quality of bone, I'm going to be doing, you know, 10 to 12 units of crown and bridge. And so I can kind of create the stream, and I can kind of balance things from the standpoint of, the, you know, like if I want to take time off, like I took 2 weeks off around in July last year. Well, I kind of scheduled July, and July was just as productive as any other month for me based on the predictability of, you know, scheduling the implant cases out.
Yeah, I think what it happens, it creates a larger case because you're doing all components of it. And I think another thing, what I see is doctors doing the implants that are doing the restorative work is it's easier to work with your own implants than when someone else places them for you. They don't quite put them in a position that you wanted them all the time. And whereas what Bernie is doing, and I have several other clients doing the same thing, Ron Zokel up in Vancouver, who has Pacific Implant Institute, several other clients as well who are doing implants, Zach Hodgins, who I mentioned, several others, they say that it's the predictability and it's the reliability. They know where that implant's going to be placed, and they're the general contractor who treatment plans the whole case, and now they're in control of each step of the way as well. Tell me how your team interfaces with this, and you use the bonus system.
Yes.
And tell me how you have five team members now. Tell us a little about how your office is set up. I mean, what positions you have. And
okay, I actually have 2 administrative coordinators.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hygienist, and I have 2 clinical assistants.
Mm-hmm. Do you use outside funding very much?
I use outside funding a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Patients, I've actually got a positive accounts receivable where I need to stay alive to treat these patients, which is a great thing. I think when I became a client, I had $150,000 of outstanding accounts. Now I'm on the other side, which is extremely nice.
Yeah.
And when you're doing cases like these, and once you get into an area where you start doing cases like these, it's amazing how patients, you say, well, this is the way we do it, and if they're not ready, you say, that's okay, fine, well, we've got the case coming this week, and so when you're ready, let us know, and we'll secure that appointment for you. When you sit from a position of authority in this position, it's really nice, and it's amazing how patients kind of think, well, I got to do it this way because he's already got other people doing it.
How did your staff make that transition from letting people put things on the books? You got to a credit balance while you were still doing general dentistry as well. Tell us some of the things that your staff did to make that transition, and how did they, besides just listening to me in a seminar, what did they do in your 4x4s to basically psychologically prepare themselves to face Mrs. Jones and say, your next step is write us a check or arrange some financing, and then we make an appointment? How did they get through that barrier?
Well, I think the best thing we did was the scripting of securing the appointments with a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get this appointment, you know, Dr. Dunn's going to reserve this time for you at this given time. We need the policy within our practice is that you make a deposit. And it worked out really well because if they're not ready to make the appointment, they don't make the deposit. If they are, we schedule them and secure it. And then at the time that they come in for the appointment, they make another payment towards it. And that's for the cases who don't do the outside financing, which I will share with you that most of them, a fair amount of them do. I apologize, I don't have the percentage statistics in front of me relative to it, and since I've been so busy, I haven't followed up with it. But the whole dialogue of making patients secure deposits, and I'm saying a third of a $40,000 case to do the procedure, and that allowed us to kind of start focusing in on getting rid of the accounts receivable and making sure that we got a positive accounts receivable for the upcoming case.
Credit balance.
My deliver the case. That's the other thing about implant dentistry, which I'll mention. When I do cosmetic dentistry, generally I can do a case in 2 weeks. That's obviously prep and provisional, create prototypes, and then come back and deliver. Well, there's 2 weeks for them to do the procedure. One thing that's nice about implant dentistry is you get this staged treatment. If I do sinus grafts, there's a fee associated with that. They can pay for that up front. And then 4 months later, then I'm going to be paid to place an implant. Well, they take that 4 months to position themselves to pay for the implants. And then 4 to 6 months, depending on the quality of bone, they're going to pay for the crown and bridge. So you're talking about working with a patient for a year and 2 months, sometimes greater, and they get an opportunity to finance it or budget, if you will, the economics of the investment over the course of a larger period of time. And it doesn't affect my practice because technically I haven't done the next procedure yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's kind of nice.
So anybody have any questions for Bernie on how he made this transition from accounts receivable to credit balance? Because I'm a big believer in dentists not carrying accounts receivable and sending out statements, and we've been pretty successful getting clients off of that situation where you've got sometimes an extra person just dealing with managing the money that people owe you, and that, of course, that's just overhead as well. And once you move into the credit balance, that is one of those positions that probably isn't necessary. And as Bernie said, he went from 8 staff members down to 4, and now he's at 5. What are some of the questions you have about how do you get out of the receivables business?
I have a question about contrasting the third down deposit for securing employment versus just like a percentage off for a full prepay. Is there one of those that typically works better?
Well, I like to get the whole thing. I like to have my clients get the whole thing before they start. But a percentage off for a prepay, the whole thing, that's fine. Like Bernie said, something.
We offer that first. We offer that percentage off for the full prepay, and I would share with you my practice now. I can speak to that. It's about 10% of the patients that get that. Now, this is not when they're doing outside finances. This is when you pay for it.
Absolutely. Sure.
You know, directly check, not even the credit card. We offer that first, and we've got about a 10% conversion ratio on that. A lot of patients go with the outside and pay for the entire amount of the procedure, even though I'll be doing it over the course of a year and 2 months.
So even though you're doing these from graft to implant to restorative, it's going to take a year plus, you're still getting you're talking the full amount for the whole amount. And
right.
So you're talking a third, you're basically getting paid in full for that first step.
That's correct.
And then you're getting the other third when you do the next step. So that's okay. Does that clarify that, doctor?
It does, yeah. It's a bit
he's being paid
with
in full
for with implants.
Each procedure that he's going, before he does any procedure, he's paid for that procedure.
Right.
I guess I was contrasting that versus, for instance, in our office, we're lucky enough that we carry a negative accounts receivable, and they're either due in full, for instance, on the prep visit, or they can do the full prepay ahead of time. It's just a little bit of a twist to pay a third deposit to reserve the appointment, and then I imagine the other two-thirds would be due at the appointment.
Right.
Well, no, actually, what he said was if he's doing grafts, that third is due now. That covers the graft, so it's due
right.
when you
That's
start.
Right. That's
the other
right.
third is when you place the implants. The other third is when you do the restorative. So he's paid in full before each procedure, even though it's a third of the full.
In essence, in the practice, the goal is the money precedes the treatment.
And one of the things that I would say for those of you that have the payment in full the day of prep, I would say just make the next step forward and have it due in full the day they make the appointment for the prep. And that's going to eliminate missed appointments. And that's going to miss that last-minute patient, that last-minute call that calls the messenger answering machine on a Sunday night and says, I won't be in Monday morning.
And I guess that's the more direct question I'm asking for, let's say, for restorative dentists where it's not a staging of grafting implants, restorative. Is there more effectiveness of, like you're saying, asking for the full prepay at the making of the appointment, or is there enough a decrease in cancellations by at least having a non-refundable third deposit and then take a play?
Well,
the other
to answer that question, what I teach and what most of my clients do on these cases, and I just had a new doctor in Chicago start. Carol, it's the doctor down in Oak Lawn who's not doing this at all, and I just got off the phone with him before I got on this call, and he's absolutely amazed, and he just tells this is not a man that's doing large restorative cases. He's now getting to where he's doing multiple units of crown and bridge, and for him, this is large cases, and he is simply telling people that because he is basically reserving the office for them for 2 hours, He requires payment in full when they make their appointment. And tonight he was flabbergasted to find out that they say, okay, and they pay him. And so I definitely recommend that you just go to the next step, and rather than getting a third, get the whole thing, and they do it the day that they make the appointment for the procedure. Because, you know, when you think about it, when you do a large restorative case or a large cosmetic case, you've done the bulk of the work at that first appointment.
Sure.
And it's so easy for a patient to get cold feet and, you know, not have the courage to tell you that they've got cold feet, but yet they'll call in, wait till after the office closes, and call and leave a message on the answering machine to say they won't be there. And now it becomes you're chasing them, and that's not fun, and it belittles the patient, belittles you. And I'm real big on talking about money up front, starting on the telephone, and then letting them know that we do have outside funding available if they would like to, that we can set that up and go ahead and set it up. And very often my clients actually set up the line of credit while they're on the initial phone call before they even come in for an exam. And now it makes that real easy. And that's becoming more and more common among our clients. Mm-hmm. So it just solves a lot of problems. Well, I want to thank Bernie especially. I want to thank all of you for being on this call tonight. If any of you are interested in our coaching program, we'll send you an email, and probably some of our people will give you a call. If you're not interested, at least have the courtesy to say, I'm not interested, and we'll leave you alone. If you're interested, we'd be happy to talk with you and see if there's something that we could help you with in your practice. Got time for one more final question for Bernie before we close the call. All right. Well, thank you very much for being on the call tonight, and we'll look forward to being on some calls in the future.